We know that pledge breaks are your least favorite part of listening to NHPR. So we've been trying really hard to eliminate them this month. If we manage it, if you help us manage it, we can eliminate those pledge breaks this month. But we need your help now to make it happen. More of your favorite programs, fewer interruptions when you make a gift now at nhpr.org. This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, longtime NPR reporter Tom Gelton, helped pioneer the network's international news coverage, posted first in Latin America and then in southeastern Europe. In those years, he reported on events as varied as conflicts in Central America, the first Gulf War, and the breakup of Yugoslavia. Since returning to the States, he's covered U.S. diplomacy and military affairs, in fact, reporting live from the Pentagon at the moment it was hit on 9/11. And now Gelton's come full circle. Having covered the news from abroad for so long, his most recent project takes on the intersection of the international and the domestic, immigration. And as he himself said last night at our Justice and Journalism event at UNH Law School, the best domestic correspondents are often former foreign correspondents because they see the country with fresh eyes. Today in The Exchange, Tom Gelton is here. We'll talk about his new book called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tom, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hi, Laura. So good to see you.
Well, talk about this ideal of American immigration that you describe in the book, Tom, this sort of how we see ourselves in that beautiful ideal light.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I've lived abroad a long time, and in many countries, perhaps most countries around the world, the idea of your nationality comes from your bloodline, basically. I mean, I lived in Germany, and no German would ever consider a Turk a German, for example, because, you know, Germans are Germans, and whether they have to have a German ethnicity. You see this in many countries. But in America, we've never had that notion. We've always had this idea, or we've told ourselves that we have this idea, that anybody can be an American. As long as you sort of accept the American creed, it's really more of a political identity in many ways, that if you believe in the principles that are laid out in our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, that you can become an American. It's a nation of opportunity. It's open to everybody. Now, the truth is that hasn't always been honored in practice throughout our history. Nevertheless, that idea has remained. And, you know, this is a book about putting that idea, looking at that idea and seeing whether, in fact, it is implemented, how it is implemented, what does it mean? What does it mean to become an American if you are, you know, from a very distant kind of culture?
Well, and we'll talk a lot this hour about how that ideal is, as you say, a myth to some extent, or at least it was for a long time. But just to inform us a little bit more, Tom, about this sort of America is not, it's not about your bloodline. It's about working hard, playing by the rules. Tell us your own family's immigration story. It's right at the beginning of the book, and it really kind of, it's the standard, typical, yeah, this is an American immigration story.
Yeah, I deliberately began with my own family's immigration story. My grandparents, all but one of them, came from Norway. And I was able to retrace the sort of the steps that each of them took and why they moved. You know, Norway, actually, in the 19th century, had one of the highest rates of population growth in Europe, and it was an agrarian state. There was very little employment opportunity. And along with Ireland and Italy, which are much more famous examples, Norway had the highest rate of out-migration in Europe at the time. And my mother's father grew up on a farm in Norway, and there was a law in Norway that the farm could only pass to the oldest son in the family because they didn't want to break up Norway's farmland. He was not the oldest son, so he really had no option but to leave, as his uncles previously had left, and he followed their trail to America. And the point that I had in telling the story was twofold. One, I found nothing in their tale that distinguished their immigration experience from that of rural people from Central America today who come to the United States. No opportunity in their homeland, no future, bleak prospects, the promise of a better life, you know, up north. And that was exactly what drove my grandparents to leave Norway. The difference is that they were Scandinavian, they were white, and that no one questioned their decision to come here. No one questioned their claim on the land that they took. No one questioned their identity or whether they could be American. And yet their experience was no different. So my point was to sort of contrast, why is it that people like my ancestors were able to come here and without any kind of resistance, had visas or anything like that? We didn't have visas back in those days. And yet today there is so much resistance to people coming for with basically the same motivation.
So at some level, it's the exact same story, you know,
the exact 200 same
years
story.
Later or whatever.
Right.
But at some level, it is, as you say, a myth. What's the mythology or the mythology that you described? What's not working for this new generation of immigrants? You're touching on it, but give us a little more.
Well, you have to go back even further than that, Laura. I mean, the truth is that for most of American history, the people who did come here, like my ancestors, were coming from Northern and Western Europe, and they were white, and they were had the same religion and roughly the same cultural background. I mean, there were language issues they had to overcome and so forth. But generally, the people who were coming to this country were of the same stock. And what has happened over time is that a much more diverse group of people began coming to America. First it was the Southern and Eastern Europeans, you know, and since 1965, when we really liberalized our immigration laws, and that's of course the anniversary of that law, 1965 Immigration Act, is what motivated this book. But after 1965, we really opened our doors much more broadly. So the immigrant flow included people from Asia and Africa and the Middle East. And so they began to encounter some prejudice that previous generations of immigrants had not encountered. And that, I think, is what explains the different attitude. That's largely what explains the different reception that immigrants these days are getting, is because they're coming from different cultures, much different cultures than, you know, sort of traditional America consisted of, you know. And so I think it's partly prejudice. It's partly racism. On the other hand, another thing is that when my ancestors came here, America was a much more open country. There were a lot more opportunities. Land was not taken. You know, my grandfather, my great-granduncles were able to just stick stakes in the ground and say, this is now my land.
You can't do that anymore. Seems amazing, right?
You can't do that anymore. So now there's a lot more competition. People are, you know, as you say, people are worried about losing their jobs, and immigrants now are seen as much more threatening than they were seen 100 years ago.
Even in that time of mass immigration, it seems there were some of these similar arguments against Jews, against Irish. We've all in this area seen those signs, you know, Irish need not apply. So some of the arguments we hear today echo back decades and decades and decades.
Oh, exactly. It's, you know, and it's hard to imagine why there could be so much opposition to Irish immigrants. Or, you know, Ben Franklin said, you know, very derogatory things about Germans, you know. So, yeah, at each stage of our history, anyone who is a little bit different, a little bit more of an other, you know, has had to overcome that. Now, the differences now today are much greater. But, yeah, you're right. At every stage, and, you know, I quote a very prestigious Harvard lawyer at the end of the 19th century who founded something called the Immigration Restriction League, who wanted immigration restricted to people from Northern and Western Europe. And he said that the Slav and the Latin and the Asiatic races are inferior races. And that was, you know, that was a very prevalent opinion at the time.
I want to ask you about the 1965 Act, because a lot of this book is focused on that. But let me also invite our listeners to join us, Tom. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with longtime NPR foreign correspondent, now the religion, faith, and belief reporter for the network, Tom Jelton. His newest book is called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. By the way, Tom is in the state for a Justice and Journalism event, which was held last night by NHPR and UNH Law School. You can join us with your questions and comments about this history of immigration, its modern application, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So again, this big 1965 Immigration Act really changed this idea of, you know, we only want people from Western and Northern Europe. But you write, Tom, that there were seeds planted earlier in the decades before 1965. What about post-World War II, Tom? How did that sort of get the wheels starting to churn toward a more open immigration policy?
Well, in the aftermath of World War II, there was the beginnings of civil rights movement in America. Remember that there was a walkout at the 1948 Democratic Convention when Hubert Humphrey famously criticized his fellow Democrats for excluding African Americans. The U.S. immigration policy at the time incorporated these national origin quotas, where visas were given out on the basis of your nationality. And in order to maintain this Western, Northern European character of our population, way more visas were given to people from those countries than from the countries where we didn't want immigrants coming from. So, you know, there were 100 visa slots a year for people from China or from Korea or from Japan or from the Philippines or from India or Pakistan. But 50,000 visa slots were reserved for people from Germany or the United Kingdom or Scandinavia. So that policy, in the years after World War II, was beginning to be questioned for the first time. The national origin quotas were reaffirmed in a law passed in 1952. But Harry Truman was furious about this, vetoed the law, and delivered a message with his veto that was really eloquent and passionate about why this was so un-American to do this. And so he was really instrumental in, as president, in really questioning this policy. And there still were not enough votes in Congress to overturn his veto at the time. So that policy stayed in place for another 10 years. But you did see from a number of members of Congress beginning in the early 1950s a real conviction that it was time that America change this policy and become truer to its ideals.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about Harry Truman, because we think of him in terms of, you know, finishing up World War II and the atomic bomb. But I did not know that about Harry Truman. What shaped his strong feelings, Tom, about this this immigration quota system?
Well, I think that, you know, defenders of the immigration quotas at that time were largely Southern Democrats, and Southern Democrats really controlled Congress at that time. You had more liberal members of Congress in both the Republican and the Democratic parties, actually more in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party. People from the North, it was the same coalition, Laura, that ultimately passed the civil rights legislation in the early 1960s. They weren't yet strong enough in the early 1950s, but the same core was there. It was largely people from northern and eastern parts of the country, you know, challenging the people from the South, members of Congress from the South, who really controlled the levers of power in Congress at that time.
What about the Holocaust, Tom, and the idea that, you know, that hideous Hitler idea of racial purity and, you know, let's go after the Jews and the gypsies and so forth? I mean, did that shape people's feelings here about, oh, maybe we shouldn't divide people so neatly and evenly?
I think it did, Laura. And you had people like Lyndon Johnson, who was a senator from Texas at the time, who had been instrumental in helping some Jewish refugees get resettled. And, you know, there was a sense of shame at the end of World War II that because America basically had closed its doors to Jews and not dealt with what was going on in Nazi Germany at the time. So I think there was a growing sense of shame at that experience. And another thing was that African-Americans had served in the military, largely in segregated units throughout World War II. But there was a sense that that was wrong, you know. And I think it was the war experience for a lot of people who were familiar with, you know, who had been in the U.S. military. There was a sense that that was, you know, that that was it was time for America to start integrating, you know, racially. So I think you're right. In the aftermath of World War II, there was a little bit of an awakening in this country to some of the injustices and the discriminatory practices that had characterized, you know, our society for so long.
The other thing that I didn't fully appreciate, Tom, until I read the book was how important immigration reform was to John F. Kennedy. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. But it's interesting. Immigration reform, even in 1960, had very little to do with Latin Americans or Asians or Africans. It had to do with some of these European countries that had low quotas. Italy, for example. There, and Kennedy, when Kennedy ran for Congress in first in 1946, there were a lot of Italians in his constituency, and there were a lot of Jews, and there were some Greeks. And he was more worried about the low quotas. You know, his voters were worried about the low quotas that their countries got. They weren't yet so enlightened as to worry about the low quotas that people from Asia or Africa had. It was mostly Southern and Eastern Europeans. There was a huge backlog of visa applications to come into the country. And John Kennedy, in campaigning, you know, had to deal with those concerns. And his grandfather had been a member of Congress who was Irish, had been a member of Congress in the late 19th century, and had famously spoken out on the floor of Congress about the unjust immigration policy that kept out too many Irish. And he was opposed at that time by Henry Cabot Lodge, one of the blue blood, the older Henry Cabot Lodge, one of the, you know, representing sort of blue blood stuck of New England, who was among those Yankees who wanted, you know, wanted the Southern Europeans kept out of the country. So an issue that had been in John Fitzgerald's campaign in the late 19th century came back in his grandson, John Kennedy's campaign in the late 1940s.
And then, of course, JFK is assassinated, and Lyndon Johnson picks this up with a great deal of passion, saying, I am going to finish this.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that I was not able to answer in doing the research in this book, Laura, is whether he committed himself to immigration reform out of a sense of loyalty to Kennedy's agenda or whether he genuinely believed in it himself. Because in 1952, when Harry Truman vetoed that law reaffirming the national origin quotas, Lyndon Johnson voted to override Truman's veto.
So really? That's interesting.
He voted with those who wanted to keep the national origin quotas. And then 12 years later, as president, he is pushing for immigration reform to abolish those quotas. I think that in the meantime, he did become sensitized, and I think he did personally come around to the conviction that these quotas were wrong. But a big part of his push for immigration reform was also his sense of loyalty to completing Kennedy's agenda.
Well, volumes and volumes and volumes have been written examining LBJ, how he thought, why he did what he did. I mean, in the end, he was a Southern Democrat, so maybe that's why he had the attitude that he had in those early days.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, it's looking at the negotiations and the debate around the passage of the 1965 Act was really fascinating. You know, you just saw some of the sort of the tail end of some of that segregationist rhetoric that people were sort of too ashamed to say in public later, you know, saying really derogatory things about Africans, for example, that, you know, would be, well, I would have thought that we would never hear that kind of rhetoric again, maybe. Maybe we are hearing some of it again. But it was just, it was fascinating. There's a little story, I don't know if, there was a lot of opposition to maintaining these, a lot of opposition to getting rid of the national origin quotas, but there was also a sense that it was inevitable. And so there was a conservative Democrat from Ohio named Michael Feehan, who was chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, who recognized that the national origin quotas were going to have to go away, but was in cahoots with those who wanted to keep it. And he figured out a way, which we can talk about after the break, he figured out a way to sort of what he thought would be the way to maintain them in practice, but not in fact.
More with Tom Gelton in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a deeper look at America's immigration story with Tom Gelton, longtime NPR foreign correspondent, author of the new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. If you have questions or comments about this immigration history that Tom is giving us, or comments on our immigration debate today, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tom, just before the break, you were starting to tell us a story about this 1965 Immigration Act, which, again, 50 years old, and how the people who wrote it didn't 100% really understand what they were doing. Go ahead.
No, I say that nobody understood. The people who supported it, the people that opposed it, nobody really had any idea what was going to happen. So there were a lot of people who wanted to maintain, as I said, this kind of Northern and Western European bias in U.S. immigration policy, but they also recognized that the national origin quotas were so inherently, so obviously discriminatory that they had to change. This conservative Democrat named Michael Feehan from Ohio figured out a way where he could sort of keep the effect of national origin quotas without actually having them. And what he did, the original version of the 65 Act, would have given out visas on a priority to those immigrants who had the skills and the education that America most needed. Those were considered especially advantageous. Well, he changed the law. He insisted, as a condition of his support for it, that it be amended to instead give preference to immigrants who already had relatives living here. And his thinking, Laura, was that if you gave preference to immigrants who already had relatives here, you'd basically just maintain the same profile of the population that was there before. Because Asians and Africans, there were very few Asians and Africans and Arabs in the country at the time. So he thought that that would be another sort of sneaky way to keep them out without sort of officially keeping them out. It was a huge miscalculation on his part because at the time, by the late 1960s, there was really no longer any pressure to come to Europe, to the United States from Europe. The great pressure to migrate was in the developing world, in Asia and Latin America and Africa. And you only needed to have one under this new system that valued family unification. If you had one student from one of those countries come here on a student visa, get a job, get naturalized, then as a U.S. citizen, he or she could then bring in his adult brothers and sisters, their brothers and sisters, their wives' brothers and sisters, and you had this exponential increase in immigration from those countries that were really pushing to move. So that's why you had this dramatic change in the profile of the immigrant population after 1965. Before 1965, 7 out of 8 immigrants were coming from Europe. By 2010, 9 out of 10 immigrants were coming from outside Europe, from these very countries that Michael Feehan and his allies had wanted to suppress immigration from. So that is, it was not deliberate. It was not intentional. It was accidental. And it was actually, you know, an effort that was intended to repress immigration from those countries actually had exactly the opposite effect.
And is that system pretty much the system that we have today, Tom?
Absolutely. 80% of immigrants coming here legally now are coming under the family unification system.
And that's how the system works. And it basically is focused on family unification. Does the system now take into account skills, what businesses want, need?
Yeah, but a tiny percentage of immigrants are coming under those old. Those categories are still there. It still is possible to immigrate to the United States on the basis of a job offer or a particular skill that's needed, but that accounts for a pretty small minority of the immigrants who are coming.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with NPR's Tom Jelton about his new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. 1-800-892-6477. And Tom, let's go to our listeners. And Marie's calling from Chester. Hi, Marie. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi. I'm of Italian descent, and my mother came over during the Depression. Her father was fleeing Mussolini and running across Europe.
Wow.
I guess he was born in England. And the only way they got into the United States, because they were barring the Italians, was he was a subject of England because he happened to be born there. And the prejudice, oh, my God, that, you know, they were starving to death. They were working all week long, cleaning rich people's homes for 10 cents a week, you know, begging in the streets, da-da-da.
Once they got to this country, Marie?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
And, consequently, they settled in communities. Like, you know, you've got Irish Boston, Brooklyn, you know, the Italians, because they bonded together. And I remember asking my mother, who had broken English and spoke total Italian to her sisters and mom. I'd say, how do you say doll in Italian? She'd go, I don't know. You speak American. the culture, because she was afraid of the prejudice.
Wow.
Yeah, and even like 25 years ago, do you remember the old Digital Corporation?
Yes.
I was working there, and I don't look Italian. I'm light-skinned, and my sister's a dark-skinned and stuff. And there was a fellow from Britain that I absolutely loved, an older gentleman named Peter. And I remember him saying to me one day, I have a neighbor, she's so nice, a little old Italian woman, she's a great cook, she cooks for me, and da-da-da-da. And he said, but you know, she's one of those Italians.
Wow. Well, Marie, thank you for calling in. There's so much to follow up on from that story.
Well, I'll just briefly say one thing, Laura. Actually, Italians were not barred from coming to the United States. But in practice, I certainly understand why she would have that impression, because there was this quota for Italians, and it was way oversubscribed, which means that if you were Italian and wanted to immigrate to the United States, you had to wait years and years and years before your number would come up, because there were so few slots reserved for Italians and such great demand. I think there were thousands and thousands and thousands of Italians on a waiting list. So in practice, you could feel like you were barred. And the reason that it was much easier to come on a British passport is because the quota for people from Britain was huge, and it was never entirely filled.
Well, and some prejudiced against Italians, some fears of Italians because they were Catholic. People called them papists.
Yeah, and they were, you know, as Marie suggested, they were somewhat more swarthy in appearance, you know, and, you know, there was that attitude.
Well, the thing I wanted to pick up on from her call, Marie, thank you so much for joining us, is she said immigrants like her parents settled in urban enclaves. Okay, right. And this gets to the book, Tom.
Yeah.
You study this history of American immigration, but then you bring it to the present, looking at Fairfax County, Virginia,
right,
a suburban county outside D.C. That's sort of a microcosm of the whole story. How is suburban immigrants' experience different from that sort of old school urban immigration story that Marie tells us?
It's very different, and that's, I think, a really interesting issue. In the past, immigrants came sort of in groups, and they tended to settle in enclaves. So you had Little Italy's, you had Chinatowns, you had, you know, you had your parts of New York that were almost entirely Jewish. When people started to come as individuals under the family unification system, they didn't necessarily go to, you know, where all the Italians lived. They settled, you know, they made their decisions individually on the basis of where is the housing most available, where is it safe, where are the best schools, where are the, you know, where can I find a job? And you got a much more diverse pattern of settlement. So Fairfax County in Northern Virginia, now, almost one out of three residents of this southern county is born outside the United States.
Which is amazing.
It is amazing.
One out of three.
Almost one out of three. There are very few places. There are a few places like that in the United States, not very many. And nevertheless, I found no part of Fairfax County that was dominated by one ethnic group. There is a something called Koreatown, but the majority of the residents in Koreatown are Hispanic. So it's where all the Korean commercial enterprises are established. So we have a new pattern pattern of immigrant settlement, where people are sort of living amongst each other. And this has actually, in my judgment, has actually favored an integration and acculturation process. Because you don't, when you had enclaves, as Marie said, you know, people continued to speak their language. They continued to live sort of among people of their own background. That doesn't happen anymore. So it's actually much more supportive of an integration, acculturation, assimilation process with this new pattern of immigrant settlement.
Marie, thank you for the call. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. And Tom, before we go back to our listeners, let's talk about Fairfax County a little bit more, because again, the book is part history and part modern examination of this amazingly diverse county. You write, change is hard. What's been hardest for Fairfax, this rapid change in the last, you know, 30, 40, maybe even just 20 years?
Well, it's been hard for many groups of people. First of all, Fairfax County went through three very traumatic processes consecutively. In 1960, it was a southern rural county segregated. Not only were the schools segregated, the neighborhoods were segregated. And over the next 10 years, through the 1960s, it became integrated. It went through desegregation. The schools were desegregated. The neighborhoods were desegregated. Desegregation is a traumatic experience for everyone involved. I mean, it involves a lot of social change. It also went through urbanization. It was a rural county that became a suburban county and grew in population dramatically, became part of the Washington, D.C. area. So that's urbanization. And then at the same time, it went through this huge immigrant influx. So the county changed dramatically through desegregation, urbanization, and immigration. And the authorities had to deal with this. They had to deal with it in the schools. They had to deal with it in law enforcement. They had to deal with it in zoning issues, governance issues. You know, people were like living in overcrowded housing. You know, it was difficult for African Americans who had worked for years and years and years to get a fair sort of proportionate share of public services. And all of a sudden, in their own neighborhoods and communities, you had immigrants coming in and sort of taking over their community centers and moving into their schools and their neighborhoods. And so there was the truth is, and I try to be candid about some of the issues that are associated with immigration, there was a lot of resistance to these new immigrants in the African-American communities. People come here and they don't necessarily have they don't really know what they're getting into. They don't have the language. They don't have the economic resources. They find that housing, is much more expensive than they thought. That transportation can be confusing. Laws are different. They don't know how America works. I mean, what you found in a place like Fairfax County, where the change is coming so dramatically, you had a lot of people really disoriented and struggling. So it's, you know, we can't minimize how difficult this and stressful this experience is, not only for the immigrants themselves, but also for the authorities and for the people who are already living there.
The people who are already there. And I did want to ask you a little bit more, Tom, about the African Americans who lived in Fairfax County. As you said, you know, struggled so hard to get a fair shake. And then all of a sudden there's this rapid change. In the book, you write about none other than Barbara Jordan, one of the first African-American members of Congress, maybe the first African-American woman member of Congress. We think of her as a civil rights crusader, but she was, well, she had some concerns about immigration.
Well, that's right. And she was chairman of, there was a commission on immigration reform that was formed in the early 1990s. And she was the chairperson of it. And when their report came out, she was the one who spoke about it. And she called for some reduction in immigration. And she was very concerned about the impact of immigration on low-income people and African-Americans in particular. You see, people who are arguing for immigration restriction now will often quote Barbara Jordan. And those arguments, I actually went into this issue a little bit, Laura. I think that where the most reasonable concerns about the impact of immigration are the effect that it has on low-income, low-skilled workers. because those are that's where you see the most competition taking place. And there is the research on this is somewhat mixed, but there are some there's some data that suggests that in fact immigrants do take away jobs from people, for example, who are don't have a high school education. If you look at that level of the workforce, the least educated, the least skilled workers, they do face competition from immigrants. Now, on the other hand, you can still conclude that immigration has a net positive effect on the economy because of the number of jobs that are created. So, but if you look at it on a segment-by-segment basis, there are segments of the workforce that undoubtedly do suffer from immigration. From, you know, experience job loss, you know, the jobs that are lost to immigrants at that level of the workforce may be more than compensated at other levels of the workforce where immigrants are more entrepreneurial, start businesses, create jobs, add to the economy. So the net effect could still be positive, but I don't think there's any point in denying that in certain aspects of the labor force, there is competition.
Let's take another call, Tom. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ron is calling from Bow. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. It's Ron Abramson. How are you?
Fine, Ron. Go ahead.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for writing the book and for being on. I work in the immigration field, and I'm currently reading Paul Quadros' book called A Home on the Field. Do you know it?
I'm sure. Ron, I don't know that. Tell us a little about it.
It's a great book about basically the integration of a Latino community into a poultry production city in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And it essentially distills all of the main issues into this one story of how he put together a soccer team, which ended up being a championship team. And the only point I want to make from that is the fact that actually putting a face on immigration, which you're doing and he did, is really the way to gaining a better understanding and acceptance and eventual integration of people into our community.
So a personal face, it isn't just this sort of broad idea of immigration and who knows who they are. And you do that in the book, so thank you, Ron, for the call. A couple families that you follow very closely in Fairfax County. Give us just a quick sketch of those families.
Yeah, well, I follow a Korean family, a Korean couple who came here separately, and both of them with very dramatic immigration stories. I follow a family from Bolivia. I follow a family from Libya. In North Africa, and I follow the story of a young woman who came here from El Salvador. And, you know, one of the things that I think needs to be emphasized and understood about immigrants is that leaving your homeland is a really a difficult step, and it's not one that appeals to everyone. I mean, some people, those who are willing, it's a very risky move. It's a risky move that is undertaken with the promise of a future reward, but in the short term, it's scary. And the people who are willing to do that are a subset of the population. They are the least risk-averse, the most enterprising, the most daring, the most courageous. And so one thing that almost all immigrants have in common is that they have been willing to take this risk. And they're more gamblers. They're not the ones who are sort of afraid and sort of shy away from risk. And so I think that one of the things that comes out in the stories of all of these families that I write about is how unique they are, how hardworking they are, how persistent they are, how enterprising they are. And, you know, they experience a lot of, they face a lot of obstacles, and their stories are not not always, you know, smoothly upward bound experiences. But they do have that all in common. They're all of them hardworking, enterprising people. And that is something I think that immigrants in general have in common. And, you know, the stories are very personal in this book. You know, it took me, we were talking before the show, it took me a long time to sort of get on a basis of intimacy and trust with them that they were willing to share this, because these are, you know, people, it's stressful. And people don't necessarily, after they've made it, they don't necessarily want to revisit, you know, the stressful parts of their history.
Ron, thank you for the call. We'll take more of your calls, questions, comments after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, America's immigration story. We're sitting down with longtime NPR correspondent Tom Gelton. He's author of the new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. We're taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Tom is in the state this week for a justice and journalism event, which was held last night by NHPR and UNH Law School. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tom, let's go right back to our listeners. And Steve's from Portsmouth. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Yes. Hello, Laura. Hello to your guests. Thanks for having this important issue on. I just want to make a couple of brief comments and observations I have. I think one thing about this discussion, and it seems to be pretty common, is the idea that seems to be a primacy of right of foreigners to be here, and this could be for any country. I think, you know, in Europe, too, there seems to be an attitude that there's a primacy of right for refugees to go to Britain or whatever the country may be. But, in fact, I think it's the primacy right of the people of each nation to be able to determine their immigration policy themselves. I think, you know, without that, the concept of a country would mean nothing. So that's one comment. The other comment is I think this idea that immigration doesn't have a deleterious effect on economies other than on the low end jobs. I think your guest was talking about only the low end have a negative impact, when in fact it's incontrovertible. History shows that any immigration at all at any time always has a very negative impact socially and economically on any country in which immigrants enter in high volumes. So I think that doesn't quite comport with reality. Also, one other comment. Am I still on, Laura?
Yes, go ahead, Steve, and then we'll jump in. Go ahead.
Okay, one other quick comment I want to make is associated with this issue, I often hear the terms, you know, fear and hatred and stuff. But in a way, I think it's the exact opposite. The impression I get now, because I hear this so much, is that's more domestophobia. In other words, the fear that people of a country would have the right to determine their own immigration policy and their own destiny economically. So I think it's the exact opposite.
All right, Steve, let's jump in on that. Thank you for calling. You know, the point that he's questioning what he calls the right of foreigners to be here. He says, what about the rights of people who are already here to determine how they want their country to look?
Well, this is
it's a fundamental question.
It is a fundamental question. You know, the idea of an immigration policy, the idea of borders and of the sovereignty of a nation and the right of a nation to set borders and control what happens in its borders is a product of the nation state. You know, before there were nation states, there were no borders. There was no immigration policy. One thing to keep in mind is that people have migrated throughout human history. I mean, for a million years, people migrate when conditions where they live are no longer sustainable. They move. I mean, that has been a fact of human existence forever, and it's always going to be a fact of human existence. And we now have global communication and transportation networks that didn't exist. So the first thing to keep in mind is that you cannot stop migration. Migration is going to happen. You can put up barriers. You can put up walls. You can try and control the borders. But at some level, it is inevitable. I do not dispute Steve's argument that a country, a nation state, certainly has the right to defend its own borders, to control its own borders. You know, we do have legal immigration and we have illegal immigration. And, you know, my book is largely about legal immigration. And I'm not saying, very few people say we should just have open borders and everybody should come in. You know, I think there is a reasonable debate about how many people should be allowed in, under what conditions, what attributes they should have. You know, that's a reasonable debate. Very few people say we should just open it up to everybody. So I don't actually disagree with Steve's idea that, you know, that we should have some control over this, that not everybody has the right to come here. I think that's a pretty wide thing. I would very much disagree with his notion that immigration is always bad for a country socially, economically, and culturally. I mean, the United States is the refutation of that. I mean, the United States is peopled by immigrants. We've been in a country country of immigrants forever, and we're the wealthiest, most prosperous country in the world today. I mean, if you look at Canada, if you look at Australia, these are immigrant nations as well. I mean, it's pretty hard to sustain that argument, and there is a ton of research on this, Laura. I mean, I'm not just speculating or opinionating here. There is a ton of research on the economic effects of immigration. So,
you know, he mentioned the word fears, and I did want to ask you about that, Tom. You look at this both now and in the past. What are some of the longstanding fears around immigration, besides the economic argument, which you just talked about?
Well, there is this age-old reaction to people who are different, you know, and I think that often we are uncomfortable around people who are different than us, you know, who dress differently, who speak languages that we don't understand. You know, I tell a story in the book of a high school in Fairfax County that went through dramatic immigrant changes, and the students who would, the new immigrant students would be speaking their languages, and students from another background would pass them in the hallway, and they wouldn't know what these other kids were saying, and they were thinking, oh, they're saying bad things about me, or they're planning to jump me after school. When you don't know what other people are thinking, you know, you have a tendency to sort of think that, oh, they're talking about me, you know, and I don't know what they're saying, and who knows what they're saying, you know. So I think that just prejudice comes out of, you know, the lack of communication, lack of contact. And when you have a lot of people from different backgrounds coming in, you've got a situation that is going to lead to fear and prejudice.
Also in our history, and probably today still, Tom, there's concern about social cohesion, that if we bring in too many people from too many different backgrounds, we won't have this, you know, we're all in this together as Americans feeling.
Right. That's one of the arguments that is put out there a long time. You get fragmentation. The downside of a multicultural nation is that people sort of are, you know, grouped with each other, and there's not that sense of a common identity. That is a serious issue.
Well, and there's criticism today that immigrants these days don't seem as committed to their new country as before, when there was zero chance of returning to the old country. You write that, you know, your Norwegian ancestors, there's no way they could go back to Norway.
Right.
It's impossible. And certainly you can't call or Skype
right.
or anything like that. Today, it's easier for immigrants to go back and forth. You
right.
can communicate. You can travel.
Right.
How has this changed the discourse on immigration and the concern that there isn't the social cohesion that we might have had with past groups of immigrants?
That's absolutely true. And there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, you know, it's not that expensive to fly back and forth anymore, even internationally. And, you know, I know, you know, in researching this book, I met a lot of very low-income immigrants from Central America, for example, who talk on the phone almost daily with their families back home because it is so cheap to do so. I mean, that's inconceivable. And so it's natural that you maintain some of those bonds. Now, yeah, but I'll tell you what, by the second generation, they're not going back. You know, they're staying here. I mean, life here is pretty good. It's much better than it was back there. And, you know, in the first generation, maybe you don't see quite that attachment to this country that you saw in the first generation of immigrants in the past. But, you know, what research also shows is that whether you're talking about English language acquisition or citizenship, that, you know, the percentage of immigrants who are determined to become citizens and go through the naturalization process, by the time you get to the second generation, or the, you know, 1.5 generation, the immigrants who come here as kids, you know, and then mature here, you get the same thing that you've always seen in this country, which is that people become American. They do.
One of the issues that came up repeatedly at our event last night, Tom, at UNH Law, were questions about Muslim immigration in particular, because that has been a lot of the focus of this current presidential campaign. And someone asked you, why does it seem that Muslim immigrants today are having an especially hard time assimilating into American culture?
It's a really important and a complicated question. I mean, the truth is that since the end of the Cold War, the violent conflicts that we've gotten into have in probably most cases involved, extremist Muslim groups who, I mean, if you look at 9/11, if you look at Afghanistan, the fights with the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, etc. So there is this new sense that our modern-day adversaries tend to be in the Muslim world. And what that means is that that inevitably provokes some fear and resentment of Muslims in this country. And maybe Muslims in this country, sort of faced with those fears, tend to withdraw a little bit more, tend to retreat, you know, keep to themselves more. So you see more of a marginalization on both sides. Also, you know, Muslims dress differently. Many Muslim women wear headscarves, and so they stand out. Their religion is not a religion that is familiar to Americans. You know, there was a recent poll taken, Laura, that showed that 84% of Americans acknowledge that they have little or no understanding of Islam. So, you know, this is a strange religion. People speak you know, dress differently, speak differently. They're associated fairly or unfairly with our enemies abroad. So Muslim immigration raises a lot of issues that other immigrant groups have not faced.
At the end of the book, Tom, you talk a little bit about the Boston Marathon bombers, an especially chilling story for us here in New England. We all know people who were, you know, at the marathon or running in that marathon. Remind us, Tom, what their immigration story was and how that plays into fears about Muslim immigrants.
Well, these are the Tsarnaev brothers who, and I think that one of the reasons that the Tsarnaev story is so upsetting to many people is because by outward appearances, they were doing well. And they had a lot of friends who were white, people, they weren't sort of stuck in their enclave. They weren't outwardly really religious. They seemed to be acculturating. They seemed to be integrated. And then they proved capable of this horrific act. You know, the Boston Globe did a very in-depth story of them, which I quote in the book. I mean, it seems that there were a lot of family problems there. There were issues of substance abuse. There were all kinds of other issues that had really nothing to do with their ethnic background. But what sometimes happens, I think, is that people who, for one reason or another, have got some issues in their own history, strike out. And, you know, in that particular case, they grabbed onto, they embraced a radical ideology that sort of provided some sort of crude justification for what they were doing. But there were other factors behind their decision to do that. It wasn't just a sort of a logical conclusion of their religion. It wasn't sort of just an extreme version of their religion. There were many other factors that led into that.
Let's take one more call, Tom, if we could. And Kimberly is up from Bartlett. Hi, Kimberly. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hello. Thank you. Tom, I have a question if you have any opinion on the temporary visa process, which is completely dependent on one individual sitting in an embassy making a judgment whether that person gets a visa within 30 seconds. And the reason I'm asking is my sister-in-law is Ukrainian, and my brother and her have two children now. We have tried to get her mother to visit us in the United States 5 times. We've applied. The last time we applied, we actually had letters from senators, from governors, and she still got denied. They didn't even look at the letters. They just told her, sorry, was for no reason at all. And I find this process very, very discriminatory. And I was wondering if you had any opinion on that.
Well, and without commenting on her particular situation, you do hear from immigrants, Tom, that, you know, doing it legally is very difficult.
It's very difficult. And, you know, it's almost become a cliche in this national conversation that our immigration system is broken. I mean, the process, there is a process by which people can come here legally. But, you know, it involves appeals. It sometimes involves appearing before judges. And there's a shortage of judges. And, you know, the process isn't working. I mean, I don't sort of get into the current political debate that much. I'm much more interested. The stories that I tell in my book are stories of families who have come here. And it's really about identity. It's about what does it mean to be American? How does one become American? How do, you know, people find the common bonds? What are their experiences? As one caller earlier said, I try to put a human face on the people who have come here. This is a complicated policy debate. I sort of stay away from the arcane policy details. You know, that's for other people to write about. I'm much more interested in the human story. And, you know, it's the sort of the day-to-day experiences of the people that I profile in this book and what you know, what they've gone through and what we can learn from their experiences, what lessons there are there. That's what interests me the most.
Well, and this relates to my last question, Tom, but I'll ask you anyway. You said at our event last night at UNH Law that your goal as a reporter now on this new beat, faith and religion and belief, and as the author of this new book, is to examine immigration in a way that's serious and fair. What do you hope to add to our current discussions over immigration or our understanding of immigration?
You know, sobriety, intelligence. I mean, I think this is a difficult issue for people to deal with, but it is so important for people to approach these issues with a sense of fairness, with an open mind. You know, it's great to ask tough questions. I was telling people last night that now covering issues of religion and faith and belief, I'm not afraid of hot button issues. I think, you know, if an issue is considered a hot button issue, it's because people are passionate about it. And, you know, I want to talk to people about their passionate feelings, you know, but I want to sort of try to break through the kind of the fear and the preconceptions that people bring to these debates to get at what are the things that really do concern you? What, you know, and let's talk about them. And, you know, it's so important to sort of raise the kind of the level of this conversation so that it doesn't involve insults and you know, anger and sort of gets a little bit, you know, stays on a level of calmness and openness. And, you know, issues of identity and faith, religion, immigration are very personal issues, but they are issues that we can talk about in an open way and we can sort of understand where people are coming from. And that's really what I'm committed to.
Well, I'm going to close out with a completely unrelated question. Tom, you told us last night that you got your professional start here in New Hampshire.
I sure did. After I graduated from college, the first place I moved was to Dublin, New Hampshire. I was learning to become a teacher in their Antioch Graduate School, which at that time was in Harrisville, down in southwest New Hampshire, and then later moved to Keene, was where I was trained. And so this was the first place I lived after graduating from college. I went on from here to spend 6 years as a teacher, school teacher in Maine. So I've got some New England connections.
Well, shout out to southwestern New Hampshire. Thank you so much for being with us, Tom.
It's always a pleasure, Laura.
Really appreciate it. That's Tom Gelton, again, longtime foreign correspondent at NPR, now the religion, faith, and belief reporter for the network. His new book is called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Jessica Hunt. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and I'm Laura Kanoy.